So, welcome, Mark, to Christy Walk. Christy Walk is on Kaurna land, unceded Kaurna land, and is a eco-community. It's a very scary world that we live in now, and I'd just like to ask you to introduce yourself first and what you do, but also to have this conversation on what's going on at the moment in Israel and Palestine.
Thanks, Sue. We've known each other a long time from the anti-Iraq war movement, and I've spent the better part of 30 years or more in the anti-war movement. But from the beginning, I had a strong interest in Palestine because my family came from the region. They were from Lebanon. And the issue with Palestine has led me into trying to work for a solution that doesn't involve continuous war or the cycle that we're seeing now of war and terror. And currently I'm a spokesperson for the Australian Friends of Palestine Association, and we are in recent times have been seeing an escalation of the level of repression against Palestinians under occupation. And then, obviously, in the last 2 weeks, we've had this horrific event in Israel where Hamas has targeted civilians en masse as well as military people. And this has given the Israeli government the excuse to launch their seventh assault on Gaza, seventh major assault in 16 years.
16?
Yes. The first one was in 2006, and then they did 2008-09, and they've done subsequent ones. And the smallest one had a death toll of about 400, and the biggest one will be this one, which the death toll is now likely to top 4,000 as we sit here. So we see the same patterns repeating themselves. Nobody asks why there is Palestinian resistance, even though we've had the United Nations, the special rapporteur for the Middle East, for Palestine specifically. We've had Amnesty International, we've had Human Rights Watch come out and document that Israel has created an apartheid state, that half the population that Israel controls are Palestinians, and only a fraction of them are citizens of Israel. The others live under occupation or they live under siege in Gaza. And this awareness of the reality of a new apartheid state existing doesn't seem to have affected business as usual in terms of the way the American government or the Australian government or the European governments relate to Israel or the Palestinians. So the Palestinians are living daily with the reality of being in an apartheid state where the whole system is geared towards the dominant group, which are the Jewish Israelis. And the questions of security, questions of just the basic ability of people to move around, to have a livelihood, to get medical care, to get an education, all of these things are subject to the dictates of the apartheid regime and in the West Bank, specifically to the military occupation. And East Jerusalem is being effectively and progressively cut off from the possibility of being the capital of the Palestinian state, because the Israelis have been settling tens of thousands of Israeli Jews around Jerusalem to try and make sure it stays part of Israel. And they've settled something like 10% of the Israeli Jewish population on the West Bank as well. And this is the West Bank is part of the Palestinian territory that was to become a Palestinian state. So the Israelis, back when in 1978, with the peace deal between Egypt and Israel, agreed to for the Palestinians to have to resolve their issue, as it was. And then in 1993, it was explicit in the Oslo Accords that Bill Clinton oversaw. Israel agreed to a Palestinian state, but they're always done on the basis of at some future stage, some future time. Interim measures, but the first thing that the Israelis get is is their security advantage. So they did that with Egypt in 1978, and they made a peace deal which neutralised Egypt as a potential military adversary. So, and Egypt had been the strongest Arab state, and it took the military possibility of defeating Israel off the table. Then, with the Oslo Accords, a Palestinian Authority was set up, and there was supposed to be a Palestinian state. But the Israelis just kept accelerating over the last 30 years under different governments, whether they be of the left or the right in Israel, or Labour and the right. They kept accelerating settlement of Israeli Jews on the territory that was to be a Palestinian state. And many people are saying, well, that's no longer a possibility to have a two-state solution. So the Israelis have publicly, deliberately undermined that possibility of a two-state solution, while at the same time rejecting the possibility of a one-state solution, that is one vote for everybody.
When you say Israelis, are you talking about the everyday person or the government?
Look, we're always talking about governments.
Yeah.
But the thing about governments is, as we know in our own country here, governments can manipulate public opinion. And if governments go down a path of confrontation which generates armed resistance or terror attacks, it's very easy to get your population behind you. Most Israelis live as we do here. They live in a modern state with reasonable comfort, safety and sort of the amenities that we have. A short drive from pre-67 Israel, that is before they conquered the Palestinian territories, a short drive from the borders of pre-67 Israel, you'll end up in the Palestinian territories, the occupied territories, where the Israeli army is on every corner and runs the place. And their life is very different. The people are living in a constant state of insecurity. They have the Israeli military acting with complete freedom in terms of what it does. It's a surveillance state. The laws are all geared to the benefit of the occupation, and the occupation is there to help the settlers, and the settlers are there to make sure there'll never be a Palestinian state. So the ordinary Israeli wants peace, as the ordinary Palestinian wants peace, and the ordinary Israeli, particularly at times like this, has absolute good grounds for feeling insecure or threatened. But the average Israeli doesn't experience the occupation. If they go out of Israel proper, they will go on Jewish-only roads to Jewish settlements. They're not actually supposed to go to Arab areas, according to the Israeli law. But they don't have no experience of the realities that the Palestinian population have to live with. And so it's harder to empathise when you don't see how people live, when you don't have frequent contact with them, and when your only experience of them is at times of tension when there's armed resistance or a terror attack. So governments become very adept at manipulating a population to get the end that the government wants, which is not a reasonable, sustainable peace. But they have an ideological commitment to no Palestinian state, and effectively to an apartheid state, because they've come out clearly and said that Israel is the state of the Jewish people and only the Jewish people, that there will never be a Palestinian state. Now, this is despite having signed agreements to say that there will be a Palestinian state, and it will be part of the two-state solution to bring peace to both sides. So Israeli governments have always had an ideological commitment to take as much of the land as they can, but they don't want the people there. And for the Palestinians, they suffered an expulsion in 1948 of half of their population. 750,000 people were expelled from their homes, and they were expelled from the area that became Israel. Now, that area was 78% of Palestine. So that Israel took 78% of the country. They expelled half of the entire Palestinian population, leaving a small remnant inside Israel. And then for 19 years, those people lived under martial law that were inside Israel. 1967, the Six-Day War between Israel and Egypt and Syria meant that Israel captured the rest of historic Palestine, the areas we talk about as being the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Since that time, the Israelis have ruled those areas as a military occupier. Military occupation is supposed to be a temporary measure. When armies are fighting and they come into control of territory that's not of their, not theirs, there is a specific arrangement whereby they can govern those territories. It's supposed to be a temporary measure because the government of those territories has collapsed and disappeared. It's essentially for the protection of the civilians. The Israelis have now maintained a military occupation for 56 years, from 1967 till the present. And it hasn't been a neutral occupation. I mean, it's the purpose of the occupation hasn't been to live in peace. It's to allow the encroachment of Israeli settlement into the territory taken in 1967. And this is something that is visible to anyone who visits Israel. You can go and you can see over 200 settlements. And the government will proudly tell you they've got 600,000 or 700,000 Israeli Jews living in these settlements. And the people in these settlements will tell you, some of them will say, well, the land was given to us by God, and that's the end of the story. Some will say, well, you know, we're not going anywhere. So the military occupation, which was supposed to be a short-term expedient, has become a permanent regime. So the Palestinians don't have citizenship in Israel, the ones that live in those occupied territories. They can't vote, they have no control over the military that rules their lives or over the Israeli government. They're being denied a state of their own, they're being denied their own self-determination, even though it was agreed to by Israel initially in 78 and then in 93, because you have the Palestinian areas were largely Palestinian, and it was seen as, you know, a possible solution that you simply divide the country. The Israeli governments over time have done everything to stop that possibility of a Palestinian state emerging. And what that means, for instance, for the current situation is that people won't live without hope. They won't live under an apartheid regime where they have no security, no hope, no ability to determine how they live, how they raise their children, whether they have work, how they control their water resources, their environment, their travel, anything like that. So people won't live under an apartheid regime without hope, without resisting. People can't. It's oppressive, and that's why it's called oppression.
Yeah.
Because it just crushes people.
Yeah. Who brokered the original deal?
Which, back in 78 or 93?
The persecuted Jewish people would go.
For the establishment of Israel.
Yeah.
Well, this is interesting because it's, this is not an age-old conflict. It doesn't go back 1 or 2,000 years. It's relatively recent in historical terms. It goes back to about the time of the First World War. Mm. So the Zionist movement, that is the movement that wanted a political state, a state established for Jews in Palestine, was a creature of the time. It was a time they were Europeans. It was a time when Europe was heavily colonial in its worldwide presence, when nationalism was raging in Europe, and this was one of the things which led to the First World War, of course. Also, in respect to the Jews, anti-Semitism was an issue, particularly in Eastern Europe. And so one of the solutions put forward to anti-Semitism was, okay, let's go down the path of nationalism rather than integrate into the European countries. Let's have a Jewish nation. Palestine has a lot of appeal. Colonialism offers us a path because if a colonial power will give us part of their empire, we don't have to worry about the natives kicking up. So the Zionist movement tried the Ottoman Empire, which then ruled Palestine up until 1917. The Ottoman Empire wasn't prepared to bring in lots of Europeans aiming to set up a European state. So they finally had success with the British government in 1917, which said to them, we will be taking Palestine soon and we will help you establish a Jewish homeland there. And this is the modern origin of the problem. So between the period of the First World War, the end of the First World War, and the commencement of the Second World War, of course, you had the terrible destruction in Europe, then the turmoil of the interwar period, the rise of fascism, and that meant Jewish refugees. And the Zionist movement brought these things together in conjunction with the British government that was then ruling Palestine under an authority system called a mandate system, which the League of Nations had set up. And so the Zionist movement with the British government managed to bring in hundreds of thousands of European Jews into Palestine for the purpose of creating a Jewish state in the face of opposition from Muslim and Christian Palestinians who said, look, we want our self-determination, we don't want to be part of a European state which is set up for Europeans. So the interwar period saw the basis for the creation of Israel aid in massive European Jewish migration. The Arabs rebelled against the British. They said, look, you can't do this to us. The Arabs appealed to the League of Nations. They did all the things that you normally use, all the avenues you'd normally try, and nothing succeeded. Commissions of inquiries came and went. And finally they rebelled and the British crushed them. And that was between 36 and 39. Now, the period of the Second World War was relatively quiet in Palestine, but at the end of that war, the momentum picked up again to create a Jewish state. The Palestinian resistance of the time had been crushed years before, their leaders killed and to a large extent disarmed. So the British pulled out of Palestine after the Second World War. They pulled out in 48. The empire was weak because of the cost of the war. And in pulling out, they handed the problem to the UN, who really didn't have the power to do anything, but they recommended a partition, which was recommended without any authority and without the agreement of the majority of the population, who were the two-thirds Muslim and Christian Palestinians. So by the time the British actually pulled out in 1948, a civil war had started and ethnic cleansing by the Jewish militias had already commenced in 1947. So by 1948, the British pull out, the Jewish army triumphs, half the Palestinian population is expelled through force of arms, massacres, rapes and fleeing in terror. That's all been documented. And here we have the nut, the essential part of the Israel-Palestine conflict, that a state was set up for European Jews in a country where they were a minority. In 1948, the Jews were one-third of the population and most of them were European immigrants. They weren't even native-born. And so the only way was to expel the majority population. So Israeli democracy is born on the basis of ethnic cleansing. And those people were never allowed to return, and something in the order of 400 or more villages were systematically dynamited and blown up to make sure they couldn't come back. And that laid the basis, that created the Palestinian refugee problem, created the basis for the Arab-Israeli wars, where the surrounding Arab states tried to regain Palestine through warfare and failed. And the period from the establishment of Israel to, let's jump forward to 1993 and say that period was marked by intermittent wars, the rise of terrorism, the conflict in the Middle East becoming a worldwide conflict. For instance, the 1973 war led to an oil crisis, which led to a worldwide recession. it led to the conflict led to the militarization of the Middle East. It led to the Middle East being part of the Cold War and Cold War rivalry. But that situation of the expulsion of the Palestinians remained the heart of the problem. And when the Israelis conquered the rest of Palestine, the remaining 22% of Palestine, in 1967, that is, as I said, the West Bank, Gaza and East Jerusalem, there was, people raised the possibility, okay, Israel's won everything now, let's talk about finding some sort of settlement. So even then people talked about the possibility of a two-state solution. But the Israelis weren't keen, and many on the Arab side rejected it as being unfair as well. So the Israelis simply ploughed ahead with settling those territories while proclaiming a desire for peace. And that's the dynamic that we've seen play out from 1967 to the present.
I don't quite understand why America is so strong on Israel's side, and the only solution that, or the only reason that I can see, is because they don't want to side with an Arab state.
Look, historically, the Americans wanted good relations with the Arab world. After the Second World War, Britain was a diminished power, and it had been the dominant power in the Middle East, particularly the oil states, which were very significant by the 30s and 40s. Now, as Britain faded as an imperial power, the Americans sought to step in, not just for their own advantage in terms of having good connections with the centre of the oil production industry in the world, but because they were involved in a Cold War with the Russians and they wanted to keep the Russians out. There was this global chessboard, you know. So the Americans historically wanted good relations with the Arabs, and there were many Americans at the time of the creation of Israel that said the United States should not back a Jewish state against the wishes of the majority of the population living there, who were Palestinian Arabs, Muslims and Christians. It will alienate the entire Arab world, it will unsettle things. Trouble was that there was no real constituency in the United States fighting for the Palestinians. In the United States, you have a significant Jewish minority who was influential back then in politics and is far more influential today. You have an electoral system where certain states are really important for a president to win, and some of those significant states like New York and California, the Jewish vote will make it or break it. So the United States, the people in the State Department who understood where the real interests of the country lay, said we need to have good relations with the Arabs. You're either going to drive them into the hands of the Soviet Union, or they're going to become communist, or they will become join the non-aligned movement, which was significant in the 50s and 60s. But we if we take a one-sided position with Israel, then we will alienate all these people. Well, in the end, the power of the Jewish lobby, the Israel lobby, however you want to describe it, was too strong in the US. Now, the US system is one where, for instance, lobbies are very significant. So, for instance, we all know about the National Rifle Association, how it is essentially determinant of the views of government as to how best to restrict gun ownership to get the sensible levels that we'd have in a country like Australia, to take that out as an element of violence of the society. You have the NRA, you have the pharmaceutical industry who makes decisions that benefit them and not the American people. So much of the US system is run, and government decision-making is run on the base of huge donations and huge lobby groups. And in the Middle East, the Israel lobby is the most significant, and their donors are the most significant in terms of American presidential elections. So US national interest has been put to one side, and the lobbies have dominated and determined US Middle East policy to a very large extent. And this was perhaps best known illustration of this was described by Walton Mearsheimer, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, who were two of the top international relations academics, and they wrote a book called The Israel Lobby in US Foreign Policy in the aftermath of the Iraq War. And they basically came to the conclusion that one of Israel's strategic aims was to destroy Iraq, that America had no interest in the destruction of Iraq. It would destabilize the entire region and fragment it, which, as we've seen happen. And they said the thing that made the difference as to whether America went to war or didn't war, the thing didn't go to war, the thing that tipped the balance in terms of America going to war against Iraq and fulfilling Israel's strategic goals was the Israel lobby in the US. So some lobbies are extraordinarily powerful, and in the United States it's a cruel, corrupt system where money dominates, and it's a real struggle to stand up to lobby groups, whether they be in industry or whether they be foreign affairs. I mean, another example is the Cuban lobby, which is often blamed for the fact that the United States still maintains an embargo on Cuba 60 and more years after the revolution, impoverishing that country. Now, I don't see that Cuba poses a threat to the United States. The countries of Latin America don't see that Cuba poses a threat to the United States. But it's no longer even looked at in that way by the United States government. Florida is a state that must be won. Florida has a large Cuban population. So decisions are made which are destructive. They're not in US foreign policy interests, and they're not in the interests of the people of the countries where they're enacted, and they're done on the basis of minority voices, powerful voices, lobby groups, voting considerations.